You are listening to a sermon by Don Tightrope, recorded on Sunday, June 14, 2009, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
When you're given lectionary texts to work with, you're never quite sure what you're going to get. So when I looked at them, I thought, that looks pretty good. But then I thought, well, we have different speakers here all the time, and you never know what you're going to get either. So I guess in that sense, it's kind of even. So as Rosie said, my topic, I entitled it Modest Beginnings, and I'm going to be concentrating more on the passages from the book of Mark, which talks of the parables. And one, particularly when you think of the mustard seed, obviously things like modest beginnings is what comes to mind. And throughout the Bible, we are reminded that God is very involved in the affairs of the world and that he does his work with or without us. In addition, from the Samuel passage, we read that God does not look only at outward appearances, but sees through us into our very core. So this morning, I want to build on these themes and show that small beginnings can, in fact, grow into great enterprises. And I want to work in a little math and finance while I do that, just for something different this morning. So I'm going to start with the parables. Rosie already read them from the book of Mark, two of the parables. And the parables, as found in the first three Gospels, come closer to the teachings of Jesus than anywhere else recorded. By using the parables to inform our view of the kingdom, we are able to get as close as possible to the mindset of Jesus. According to Mark, Jesus rarely taught without a parable. In fact, about a third of all of his teachings, of the teachings of Jesus, are recorded in parables. Many of the parables attempt to portray an image of the kingdom of God. And we read in different places, "The kingdom of God is like," in the parable of the leaven from Luke, "to what shall I compare the kingdom of God? It is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal till it was all leavened." Or we read the parable of the hidden treasures and the pearl from Matthew. "The kingdom of heaven is like treasures hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has, and he buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had, and he bought it." In the parable of the mustard seed, it says, "With what can we compare the kingdom of God? Or what parable shall we use for it? It is like the grain of mustard seed, which, when sown upon the ground, is the smallest of all the seeds on earth. Yet when it is sown, it grows and becomes the greatest of all shrubs, and puts forth large branches, so that the birds of the air can make nest in its shade." Whenever I'm looking at or starting off on these kind of things, my first thing is inevitably I go to the internet. What does it have to say? So I have to do a search or two to see what information I can gather. And a couple of interesting facts. When I did a search for mustard seed, you get all kinds of results. Nothing has anything to do with mustard seeds. Almost every single search result you get has to do with descriptions of one Christian organization or another and describing the ministries that they offer, and typically based directly on this parable. They've named themselves the Ministry of the Mustard Seed. And most of them, or many of them, are ministries feeding the poor. The second interesting thing that I found is that 90% of the mustard seeds produced in the world today come from only one country, and 50% come from one region of that one particular country. And I was kind of surprised. I heard Peter, you just know these?
Saskatchewan.
That's right.
Really?
Canada produces 90% of all the mustard seeds produced in the world, and Saskatchewan produces 50% of all the mustard seeds produced in the world today. In this parable, It is not that the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed, or that it is like a great shrub, but rather that the kingdom of heaven is like the process that sees the one transformed into the other. There are two different versions of the parable of the mustard seed, one in Mark and one in Luke, and the parable is also found in the Gospel of Thomas. But the differences between them are all quite small, and they do not change the meaning of the parable. Jesus compares the kingdom of God to a mustard seed, or more accurately, what happens to the mustard seed when it is planted. The mustard plant begins as most inconspicuous, the smallest of all seeds. And while it's not technically true that it is the smallest of all seeds, it is the smallest of all seeds which become a useful plant and are commonly planted. And it becomes a conspicuous, a large plant, according to Mark, or a tree, a small tree, according to Luke. To call a mustard plant a tree emphasizes its size. It is almost as large as a tree. This illustrates the truth that it is impossible to tell the magnitude of something from its beginnings. There's a second aspect to it in that not only was there a huge increase, but also a substantive change, that is, a mustard seed becoming a tree or a shrub. This clearly represents the viewpoint that the kingdom is present in the world today, growing and transforming the world all around it. In the parable, both the contrast between the beginning and culmination of the kingdom of God and the process of growth from the one to the other are emphasized. Jesus' point is that the kingdom of God is an historical process that has begun inconspicuously in his appearance and work, but will grow towards a conspicuous result, which no one will be able to deny. It is possible that the depiction of the mustard plant as large enough to support birds on its branches is a metaphor of the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, as offering protection to those within it. On this, it picks up from themes from the Old Testament. In Daniel chapter 4, we read, "These are the visions I saw while lying in my bed. I looked, and there before me stood a tree in the middle of the land. Its height was enormous. The tree grew large and strong, and its top touched the sky. It was visible to the ends of the world. Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and on it was food for all. Under it the beasts of the field found shelter, and the birds of the air lived in its branches, and from it every creature was fed." Or in the book of Ezekiel chapter 17, "On the mountain heights of Israel I will plant it. It will produce branches and bear fruit and become a splendid cedar. Birds of every kind will rest in it, and they will find shelter in the shade of its branches." So here Jesus in his parable is reminding his listeners of the connection between the New and the Old Testament. One of the factors that made the parables of Jesus so powerful to his listeners is that he framed them in terms of the daily experiences of the people who were there and listening to him. Most of his audience would have had a direct experience with agriculture and would appreciate how he presented their everyday reality of lives in a new way and used it to contrast with the kingdom of God and things which they did not understand. Although I myself am only little more than one generation removed from the farm, agriculture does not reflect my daily reality. So let me frame the parable slightly differently by introducing a similarly powerful force underlying our world by telling you a fable, and one which many of you have probably heard. The story goes that the ruler of India was so pleased with one of his palace wise men who had invented the game of chess that he offered the wise man a reward of his own choosing. I brought my own chess board today. You can print anything from the internet. So I'm just going to leave that right there. The wise man, who was also a mathematician, told his master that he would like just one grain of rice on the first square of the chessboard. Got my grains of rice. They're bigger than mustard seeds, but I can actually see these ones. So he wanted one grain on the first. And then he said, on the second he would like two. And then keep going like that. So there's 100% increase on the third square. There's now going to be four. And then you just keep going. So you just eventually... So you double the number of grains of rice on each of the next 62 squares on the chessboard. Well, it seemed like a modest request to the king, so he called the servants to bring the rice. How surprised he was to find that the rice quickly covered the chessboard, then filled the entire palace. The number of grains of rice on the last square would be, in mathematical terms, 2 to the 63rd power, where 2 increased by 100% on each successive square. And if you use, you pull out your calculator and you calculate it, it says the number works up to be 18,500, and then it follows 15 zeros. So I don't know how to describe that number. Once I get past a trillion, I don't know what the numbers are anymore. Pardon? You know, somebody probably knows. So when I'm just trying to understand length or distances, people often say, well, it goes around the Earth at the equator one or two times, something like that. Well, in this case, if I took each of those grains of rice just from this last square and placed them end to end, they would in fact reach further than around the Earth. They would go past the Moon and the Sun, and they would reach to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, which is 4.4 light years away, and then they would come back to the Earth again. Just from this little chessboard. The second parable found in Mark, the parable of the seed growing by itself. And he said, The kingdom of God is as if a man should scatter seed upon the ground, and should sleep and rise night and day, and the seed should sprout and grow, he knows not how. The earth produces of itself, first the blade, then the ear, then the full grain in the ear. But when the grain is ripe, at once he puts in his sickle, because the harvest has come. This is a parable unique to Mark. And in it, Jesus compares the kingdom of God to the event of the seed that is sown, grows without the help of human beings, and culminates in a harvest. The entire parable consists of just three sentences. The first sentence contains three sets of verbs, controlled by the word as, and focuses on a man who sows. The focus of the second sentence is on the growth of what was sown, and he describes it in three stages of growth. The blade, the head, and the ripe grain. This continues the theme of growth from the end of the first sentence. The third sentence has three verbs. And in it, the man who sowed reappears, but this time as the reaper. The idea of the ripe grain connects the verse 28 and verse 29. The emphasis of the parable has been placed upon the one who sows the seed, on the growth of the seed and the contrast between the seed sown and the harvest, on the earth and its power to bring forth grain apart from any human effort, apart from the harvest. The fact that Jesus compares the kingdom to a seed growing towards maturity implies that he sees the kingdom of God as a historical process that has a beginning and an end. In spite of the differences between a seed and a fully grown plant, there is an identity and a continuity between them. In the same way, the kingdom of God is always present, but inconspicuous, and will progress towards its completeness. Given the unexpected stress on the seed's growth as independent of all assistance from human beings, Jesus is also making the point that the kingdom is outside the control of humans, in the same way that a plant grows without additional human assistance. In the parable it says, all by itself, regardless of what the sower does subsequently, although he gets up night and day, whether he sleeps or he does not sleep. The kingdom of God necessarily grows until it reaches its completion. The statement that the sower does not know how the seed grows likewise contributes to the idea that the kingdom is outside the control of human beings. In one of the recent James Bond movies, the villain is a character named Le Chiffre, which in English translates from the French as the figure or even the cipher, which is appropriate because he is the banker of choice for international terrorists and drug dealers. In one of the early scenes, one of his clients, who is in the process of entrusting tens of millions of dollars, ill-gotten dollars, of course, to him, asks him, this man, the sheikh, does he believe in God? And he replies, no, in fact, he does not. What he does believe in is a reasonable rate of return. At first glance, it may not seem an odd quote from a villainous character who professes non-belief in God. And yet there's a profundity in his response that goes beyond Paul's much misquoted statement that the love of money is the root of all evil. As with the first parable of the chessboard, let me give you a more contemporary illustration, one that, because of my background and interests, resonates more with me. Like the growing seed in the parable, there is a powerful force at play here, the power of compound interest. For example, it is said, a penny saved is a penny earned. This quote is often associated with Benjamin Franklin, who lived from 1706 to 1790, but it actually goes back much further. And in its first incarnation, a penny spared is twice got, which is a quote from Outlandish Proverbs, which was put together by George Herbert in 1630. Now, this is the same George Herbert of whom Rosie has spoken, and who wrote the hymn, which is in our hymn book, Come My Way, My Truth, and My Life. And he put together one of the first collections of Proverbs. And then we read another one. I saved £5 out of the brickmaker's affair. It's a very good thing to save one, let me tell you. A penny saved is a penny got. And this is from Charles Dickens in Bleak House. And then a more contemporary one. This is from The Family Circus, quoted in Washington Post. A penny saved is a penny earned, but what can I buy with it? Well, what exactly can our pennies and dollars earn? And what would have resulted if one of our ancestors had had the foresight to put away a small sum back in 1630 when George Herbert's Outlandish Proverbs were first published? Well, an argument could be made that you could earn about 3% a year. It turns out that a form of British government savings bond called a CONSOL, or originally short for Consolidated Annuity, has been continuously outstanding and paying interest at about 3% interest rate since the early 1700s. In financial terms, unlike theological, such an outstanding history of payment is considered perpetual. So what does 379 years of compound interest going back to 1640 give us? And here's one of the powers of compounding. We don't just receive interest on our original investment, but as in the example of the chessboard, each year we receive interest on the interest that we have received, and so on, year after year after year. Compounding is a fundamental, powerful, invisible property of our world. Like the wind, it is not something that we see. However, we note its effect. Great financial fortunes of the world are based on the power of compound interest, while at the same time it can cause distress, as anyone who has outstanding credit card balances or mortgages knows only too well. Over the course of the last 12 months, we have seen that the power of unpaid debts have come very close to bringing down the entire financial system of the world. But back to my original question. 3% interest over 379 years would equal a growth rate of 54,000 times. $1 from George Herbert's time would equal $54,000 today. $10 would equal $540,000. $100 would equal $5,400,000 now. If we could increase our rate of return from 3% to 4%, the rate of increase over 379 years, instead of being 54,000 times, becomes a factor of 2 million times. Like the sower in the parable, the growth and the increase come without our efforts. To me, compound interest is simply one of the powerful fundamental forces that shape the world we live in, being neither inherently good nor bad, although it can produce good and bad results. From our Mennonite agricultural roots, we can appreciate the growth of the tiny seed into a large plant that produces many times over. Although we watch over the seeds, we water them, we plant them in a good spot, the actual process of the growth is not in our control. And as any gardener knows, seeds also produce weeds, which can be as plentiful, if not more so, than the desirable plants. I liken it also to the force of the wind, which we do not see but feel its effect. When Elvira and I traveled recently to Belize, we appreciated the gentle breeze, which cooled us from the intense tropical sun. When the wind level picked up, we were able to windsurf on the water as there was enough strength in the wind to move us. But Belize is also subject to the powerful destructive forces of hurricanes. In 1961, Hurricane Hattie essentially destroyed Belize City, the capital, killing 319 people. Belize City was rebuilt, but the capital was moved to Belmopan, 80 kilometers inland, to shield it from the potentially devastating effects of the wind. But who is in control of these powerful forces? It's not us. So who is it? Let's step back for a moment from the parables and look at the other readings for today. In the book of Samuel, the first verse of chapter 16, we read that God sends Samuel to Jesse because he has chosen one of his sons to be king. Samuel has been through this already once before when he anointed Saul to be the first kingdom of Israel. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1, we read that Kish had a son named Saul, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a full head taller than any of the others. So it is perhaps not surprising then that we read in verse 6 of chapter 16, when Samuel saw Eliab, the oldest son of Jesse, and a fine physical specimen, he thought, surely this is the Lord's anointed. But no. One by one, the sons are brought before Samuel, and they are rejected. In verse 7, it says that the Lord does not look at the things human beings look at. People look at outward appearances, but the Lord looks at the heart. David was the youngest and a mere shepherd boy, but he was the one that God had selected. From here we see that, in fact, it is God who is directing the drama. From Psalm 8 we read, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you were mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? In the lectionary passage today, there is so much material, I think, that it's possible to start another sermon at this point. However, what I take from these readings is that our world is shaped by powerful forces, some of which we can only see abstractly and are only now beginning to understand. But we are given assurance that it is God who is in ultimate control over these forces. We read from the lectionary passage in 2 Corinthians, verse 7. We live by faith, we do not live by sight. And also, quoting Hebrews 11, chapter 11, verse 1. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. So let me leave you with just one more number, a very modest number, the number 1. 1 may not sound impressive, but with the power of steady compound increase, it has meant that one man, Jesus Christ, increasing his followers by an average of 1% for 2,000 years, equals 2 billion Christians we find in the world today.